Hello, you are listening to Democracy Watch, the News Collective's weekly news report, bringing you alternative and undercovered current affairs from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. My name is Alex DeBoer.
I'm Arman Rana.
I'm Ben Nelson.
And I'm Milena Carrasco. It's Thursday, August 8th at 5:01 p.m. We're broadcasting from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
On today's show, we're talking about bike theft in Vancouver. So you're going to hear some stories of bikes that were stolen, forgotten, and forsaken. We also speak with the Vancouver Police Department to learn what measures they're taking to prevent theft, if those measures work, and if profiling is involved.
After that, we take a look at local business. The News Collective's Adeline Peng interviews Bella Roma Pizzeria owner and chief executive chef Jimmy Kinda.
But first, Arman, Milena, and Ben give us some headlines from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland.
Thanks, Alex. So on Wednesday, the federal government announced a $184 million investment in affordable housing in Vancouver. The total investment, including the city's contribution, is a $250 million investment to build 1,100 homes in Vancouver. But as Dan Fumano of the Vancouver Sun reports, the 1,100 homes had already been announced and were already in various stages of development.
Right.
Further, of the 9 projects mentioned Wednesday, 7 were announced in 2018 by then-Mayor Gregor Robertson. These 7 projects are a partnership between the city and the Community Land Trust, a nonprofit developer. The federal contribution consists of $114 million in low-interest loans and $69 million in direct funding.
UBC's Africa Awareness Initiative has been a long-time advocate for the MOA to improve their display of African collections. Many African students have said how most of the collection retains and reflects mostly the colonial agenda and doesn't really focus on the concern of cultures and communities of origin in Africa. Decolonizing Africa in MOA's collections and displays was received on August 2nd, $95,000 in funding from UBC's Program for Undergraduate Research Experience, PURE Initiative. The project is going to engage undergraduate students in historical and cultural research to reclassify the African collections and finally give them their place and significance in the MOA and in UBC at large. This means that UBC is going to be employing 32 undergraduate students to work as researchers for the project. So this is going to start from September 3rd until April 3rd of 2020. And if any UBC students want to get involved, you have the opportunity to apply through Careers Online or on the MOA website until August 16th.
Sweet. And also, just in case people don't know, the MOA stands for the Museum of Anthropology. That's great.
Okay, so just a little update on the Little League World Series story from last week. So the Little League World Series Canadian Regional Tournament is now a week in. So far, British Columbia and Quebec are the regions to beat. BC is currently 5-1 with their only loss coming to Quebec. Quebec has been dominating throughout the entire tournament, defeating second place BC 12-2. Quebec is currently undefeated and are 5-0. They play Ontario in their final group stage game tonight. The group stage of the tournament concludes tonight with Alberta against the tournament hosts from Ancaster, Ontario. Tomorrow, the semifinals will commence with the first-place team against the fourth-place team and the second-place team against the third-place team. It is all but official that Quebec will be the first-place team and British Columbia will be the second-place team going into the semifinals. Should Quebec win the tournament, it would be the first time Quebec has represented Canada at the Little League World Series since 1992. The conclusion to the regional tournament will be a nail-biter.
All right. Thanks, Ben. Seems like Quebec is doing really well. Moving on from stolen bases to stolen bikes, here we go. Our first piece on stolen, forsaken, and lost bikes in Bike City or Van City or Vancouver. Okay, here we go.
Really? How so? I've never heard a bro say that.
You were like, namaste. It's like,
oh, because they were
cowabunga.
Because it's like, they're like making fun of it.
Yeah, they're like new age or whatever.
All right, can we just pretend I never said it?
Namaste. Well, I have a Chad Sloan Yip here.
Come on.
Okay. All right. Jasper, can you tell me about having your bike stolen?
Sure.
A lot of people in Vancouver bike, and most of us bikers, have experienced that sinking feeling. That feeling of wanting to feel the wind blow in your hair as rubber hits the road, but that sadly, your favorite two-wheeled ride, your most trusted friend, your ticket out of sitting in a crammed, full, smelly bus that drives too slow, is no longer around. And that's what we're talking about today. CITR News presents Bike City. We're not skidding around. In your eyes.
Well, I used to live on the corner of 4th and Fur, and I was on the second floor, and there was no elevator, and I used to own a really heavy bike. And I remember coming home one day and thinking, like, I should really bring my bike up, but I was really tired. And so I locked it up out front, and I thought to myself as I walked up the stairs that my bike was probably going to get stolen. It's true. I really had that thought.
Wow.
And I came down the next morning, and my bike was gone, and I thought, okay, well, at least I saw it coming. So later that day, I was downtown with my partner, and we were in Yale Town. It was summertime. I was wearing flip-flops. I was drinking a slushy, and I saw two men biking down the street, and one of them was on my bike, and I knew it was my bike because my bike had a cup holder on the front that was very distinctive, and it was kind of broken so that you could lift it up like this. So I dropped my slushy, like I literally dropped it, and nice. I kicked off my flip-flops, and I ran barefoot for several blocks to chase them down, and they didn't know I was chasing them, and they weren't going very fast. And nice. when they hit a red light, I approached the bike, and then I straddled the front wheel, and I grabbed the cup holder, and right. I tested it to make sure it was mine. Can I swear on this show?
No.
And I said, "That's my effing bike, man." And then the man got very defensive and said, "Whoa, whoa, sorry, hey, whoa, whoa." And then he got off the bike and gave me my bike back. So I got it back within, a few hours of it being stolen.
You are a hero.
I felt great.
Yeah.
For the rest of the day. I felt like it was one of the greatest days of my life, actually. To do something like, to get the opportunity to do it and to succeed.
It's like worth having your bike stolen so that you could recover it in such a heroic and stealthy way. Like you like running beside them
barefoot.
Not knowing. Barefoot. You're like deking people out along the sidewalk.
Yeah. And I was a young guy and these were two grown men. Like big, they were bigger than me.
Yeah.
You know. And I remember thinking at the time when I saw the bike that if I didn't do anything, I would hate myself.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Totally.
Like, if I didn't act immediately, that I would regret myself and be ashamed of myself.
Mm-hmm.
So it felt really great. I remember riding back on the bike to meet my partner, who had no idea what I was doing.
Yeah, I was going to say, did you say to her, like, "That's my bike"?
No, it was, I may have, I don't remember, I may have said something, but mm-hmm. I really just took off.
Yeah.
But because I remember like coming back on the bike and they were really confused as to like where I had gotten the bike from and pretty much everything that had just happened was confusing for them.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah. We're shaking hands. Let's shake hands. Okay. But there's another story that you have, which is also good and has to do with a bike. Please share.
I have another story. Well, this is a different bike, and this was a couple years ago. I went downstairs to go to work one day, and my bike was gone. And I thought, okay, my bike has been stolen from my building. And then I went to work, and a few months passed, and then I went to this faux restaurant that is on the street that I live on. It's about 3 blocks from my house. And I noticed that my bike was locked to the the bike lock out front of the restaurant, and it had been stripped of its parts. And I thought, like, wow, that's my bike. And I knew it was mine because it has I replaced a nut on it, and it had this aftermarket nut that was very identifiable. And so I thought to myself, like, someone stole my bike from my house and used my lock to lock it to this thing, and then they stole all the parts from it. And then I realized what I had done, which was that two months earlier, I had biked to go get the bowl of soup, and then I had walked home and just left my own bike on the street about two blocks from my house for several months, and my bike had been stripped of its parts. So I unlocked the bike and I took the lock back, and I just left the frame and the rest of it there for other people to have because I was too sad.
Oh, that's nice of you.
To rebuild the bike.
Aww.
Yeah.
That is pretty funny that you left your bike in front of the faux place and thought it was stolen and never realized that it was two blocks from your house.
It's extremely embarrassing. Yeah, because I had to go buy, because the bad thing is that I thought my bike has been stolen, and it's a very, it's not like an expensive bike, but it's a very uncommon bike. Mm-hmm. And I was searching Craigslist for it, and then one of them popped up, and I was like positive that it was the person who had stolen my bike. So I was going to go to the stranger's house and like pick a fight with them and steal their bike from them. Yeah. Yeah, so those are my bike stories.
Nice.
My Vancouver bike stories.
Your bike's been stolen twice?
Well, it's been stolen once, and I lost it. And I lost it. I didn't even know if it qualifies. It was forgotten once. It wasn't even lost. I just left it.
That's funny.
On the street.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Thank you, Jasper, for sharing your stories.
Thanks, Alex.
Hey, Lee. Can you tell me your story about your bike getting stolen?
Yeah. So I was traveling in the winter of, 2013, 2014 or something. And I lent my bike to a friend who wanted it for the winter. And they were riding around for the months that I was gone, and at some point had it locked up outside their house for a couple days, maybe, where they weren't using it. And when they came back to it, the seat post and the seat had been stolen, and in its place had been left a Tim Hortons gift card and potentially an apology note. I can't remember.
It was a lot of years ago.
It was a lot of years ago, yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and then when I got back, I just had to ride it around without a seat post for a while, which is exhausting because you can't sit down. And then I left it outside one of my friend's house, and then it was fully stolen. So...
Wow.
Yeah.
It was slowly stolen.
Yeah.
I just think it's kind of like your friend kind of sucks. Like he didn't even replace your seat.
No. She did not replace the seat.
Sorry.
And she also did not give me the Tim Hortons gift card.
This is unbelievable.
She used it herself and said, "Hey, your seat got stolen. They left this." And then I used it. And I said, "Thanks."
Well, you are a nice guy.
Last time I lend you anything.
Yeah, no kidding. What then? When it was stolen, did you have it like locked and stuff? What were the conditions under which it was finally stolen?
No. If I'm being really honest, I left it outside a friend's house unlocked, probably because I was feeling careless because I was exhausted from riding around without a seat.
Thank you, Lee.
You're welcome.
Best bike wishes to you.
And to you.
And to you. Hey, Shaoli, it's Alex.
Oh, hi.
Hello.
Hello.
What number are
you calling from? A different one.
I'm calling from a CITR phone because I'm in the studio.
Am I on air?
Yeah.
Oh, hello.
This is a live conversation. No, you're not on air, but I'm recording you.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
So much to cut up for you.
Yeah. Yeah, would you mind telling me your story of bike theft?
Yeah, no. So I owned a pretty normal commuter bike. It was just this, like, I had it for a couple years. I rode it quite often. I live in a house in East Vancouver with four other women, and I would lock it to my, like, our chain link fence, and I would lock the frame and the wheel and do it all. I was usually pretty cautious about locking it when I was out, but I guess at my own house, like, I was still quite cautious, but oftentimes I wouldn't lock the frame and the wheel. And I suppose on one day, I think I just locked the frame in and didn't lock any of the wheels in. And I think I came home around like one or something. Like, I was like, it was like midday, and I locked my bike up on the side of the house, and then I went inside for like 3 or 4 hours, and then I came out to leave again, and the wheels had been stolen. Both of them. And the frame was left, just locked in place. And like, I don't really remember who was home or who wasn't home, but it was like midday, fairly, like, people are always out and about in the neighborhood. And yeah, someone just stole my wheels. And I've just never did anything with the frame. Was pretty bummed about it for a long time, but also didn't really look into doing anything about it.
Yeah.
So, there's no real way to figure it out.
Yeah, it's hard to track down wheels, especially.
Yeah, like, just the wheels.
Prove those are yours. It's a bit tough.
But yeah, that's all that happened.
Well, I'm sorry that happened to you. Thank you for sharing that story, though.
Thanks. I think it's a pretty common occurrence. The weirdest part about the story is that it was, like, right by my home.
Yeah. Yeah, that feels pretty bad.
And, like, on the inside of the fence. So someone was, like, pretty close.
Yeah.
But who knows?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, it happens to the best of us.
Okay.
Thank you for chatting with me.
Of course. Thanks for calling.
No worries. Okay. Bye.
Bye.
Hi, John. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Alex. How's it going?
Are you in a rush?
a little bit. I got a meeting in 12 minutes that I got to patch someone into.
That's true.
And I'm really patch terrible at conference
you
calls.
An adult.
So. Yeah, you'd think. I don't know how to use phones, so I'm not sure how I'm doing, but yeah.
Well, welcome. Jasper greeted us by saying namaste.
I don't agree with that. No, well, I'm sorry. No, I don't. I have nothing against saying
I
it. I just
also don't.
I am not
poor
the
guy
person who is to say namaste,
nah,
in my opinion.
Nah. Okay. John, tell us about a bike theft/recovery you witnessed.
So this was a pretty cool story that informed a bit of a role model story. Even though this person was the same age as I was a late developer, you know, developed late rather. late bloomer is the word for that. So anyhow, this is it was a real inspiring story of like bike theft and recovery and also mediation as well. Mediation and tactics for calming down difficult situations or not instigating those difficult situations to begin with.
A lot of lessons here.
So this is in grade 11 or 10 or maybe even 12. I was, you know, right after 2:50, that's when the last class gets out at McRoberts, unless you're one of those Uber keeners and you're sticking around for like some, I don't know, math whiz bullshit or something like that. Anyhow, so I'm going home. So I'm on the way home. This bus is super packed. Richmond, for years, had a serious – these buses are just too full. But anyhow, we're all here on the bus together. People who have been just out for the day, crammed in with all these students from grades 8 through 12. For those of you who didn't go to high school in BC, we don't have a junior high. We only have high school, 8 through 12. That's it. Unless you go to a private school. So – I was on the bus. I was near the back. This couple dropped off a bike at the front of the bus. Then they came all the way to the back. They were a bit scruffed up, like, you know, sweaty, just looked like they'd been out hiking all day, you know, just having a grand old time. So this bus is filling up. Then suddenly, you know, this guy, I'll name him for discretionary purposes, but one of the athletes, student athletes at the school, and pretty cool guy, I'd say, all around, like well-spoken, like just intelligent, like super cool guy, came on the bus and, you know, kind of looked around his big imposing self and said, "Hi, excuse me, who put that bike at the front of this bus?"
A bike at the front of the bus.
Yeah, did I not say that?
I'm not sure. You might have.
Okay, well, sorry. They attached a bike
right
to the front of the
bus.
No,
I think you did.
Yeah.
Can't remember. Anyway.
So I'm looking at this couple, and they're just staring stone-faced into the...
Because you saw them put
I saw them put the bike onto
so
the bus.
So you know who they are. Okay.
Precisely. I have been following this. I know, I have the scoop. So he says, this is a very admirable thing, I think, for him to say. I think this is the right approach. It's a non-punitive approach. He says, this is my bike. It was stolen from my garage like 3 days ago. I don't want to press charges, but I'm going to take it back now. I'm going to take my bike back now. And he asked the bus driver to stop, and he got off the bus, and he took his bike off the rack, and then he rode off. And the couple didn't say a word. Didn't say, you know, if you looked in their eyes, you could see. You could see the truth of it.
Yeah.
But and that was it. And this was just a little thing that happened on a packed bus. And I think it was the right way to deal with that kind of situation.
That's amazing. Diplomatic, courageous, good public speaking on a moving vehicle.
Yes.
Checks all the boxes. Thank you for sharing that story, John.
All right, thanks, Alex.
After chatting with these friends about their stolen, forgotten, and swapped bikes and bike parts, I reached out to the Vancouver police to discuss what happens with bikes when they're stolen, whether theft is on the up, and how Vancouverites can protect themselves from bike thieves.
Hello, Jason speaking.
Hi, this is Alex from CITR calling.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, how are you?
Good, what's going on today?
Not too much. We have a new show at 5, though, so that's kind of the main event of the day. Yeah, thanks for taking the time to chat with me. Would you mind just telling us again who you are and what you do with the Vancouver Police?
So, yeah, I'm a sergeant with the Vancouver Police. My name is Jason Robillard, and I'm a media relations officer.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
So, as you know, I'm calling to chat about bike theft in Vancouver.
Sure.
So I was wondering, could you tell me first off, how common bike theft is in the city?
Well, it's kind of a tough question to answer, but I have some stats available to us that I got for a recent request, and this was in July 9th. So what we did is we compared the year to date up to July the 9th, and we compared it with the year prior in 2018.
Mm-hmm.
So when we looked at those months, we noticed that there was actually bike thefts in the city were down by 14%. So that was a good thing for us. But overall, it can be, you know, just because we have an increase in bike lanes and it's such an amazing city that we have a lot of people that use bikes to commute to and from their destinations here in the city. So with an increase in bikes, we are going to see an increase in bike thefts.
Right.
So it is a problem, and you know, we support some projects like Project 529. I don't know if you're aware of that or the app that you can get.
Yeah, I am.
Okay, good. Yeah, so those are some initiatives that we support and that we really push. And when we're looking at bike theft in the city from a policing perspective, I mean, we obviously will investigate crimes and thefts and things like that, but it's a combined effort with everybody. So we like to get some awareness out there to cyclists and to anybody that sees anything suspicious, obviously to call 911 so we can help catch these thieves. But it goes sort of beyond that, and it's sort of deterring things. And when it comes to bike thefts, it's not the actual theft itself. It's recovering bikes. And through the course of our duties, we do recover, you know, roughly 2,000 bikes a year. And we have noticed where the problem is we have a hard time returning those bikes to the rightful owners because people haven't made a police report with the actual identifying marks on the bike.
Yeah, totally. I wanted to touch on a few things you said there. But first off, just to go back to the beginning about bike theft. So part of the reason there's a lot of bike theft in Vancouver is, like you said, because it's kind of a bike-friendly city. Is that...
Yes.
Yeah, so I'm just wondering, are there sort of more bikers on average in Vancouver than other major urban cities in Canada?
It's a hard question to answer, but I would just from speaking from my observations here as a police officer here in the city, I just see cyclists all over the city every day.
Yeah.
I can't speak to other cities. I'm sure that they have cyclists, but when you look at our weather, we don't have as harsh as weather as they do, say, in Ottawa. And in Ottawa, they actually skate to work in the wintertime. But I've seen a lot of people riding their bikes year-round here in Vancouver.
Yeah.
So it's becoming very, very popular here. And you can see why. And it has to do with our climate, the West Coast. And the city really supports it. It's a green initiative. We obviously support it as well. It's an easy way to get around. I personally do it when I'm downtown. I'd rather bike than take my car down here. It's just a lot easier and cheaper and healthier, and there's some really nice seawalls and things like that. So you look for Vancouver, it's definitely very popular, especially in the warmer months.
Right. Yeah, definitely. So I actually had my bike stolen a few weeks ago, which is more or less my own fault because I didn't lock it. Lesson learned. But so shortly after it was stolen, I was listening to the CBC. And they were just going over local news, and they said, as if they were talking to me directly, that chop shops are flourishing in Vancouver's east side, which is where I live. So I was wondering if you could talk a bit about chop shops in Vancouver and start out by just explaining what they are for our listeners.
Yeah, I think a lot of people, that there's a bit of a misconception about bike chop shops. I think that was sort of came out of the media. As a police officer here, I'm not aware of that being a huge problem. I do know that there are bikes that are stolen, but when it comes to chop shops, that's typically a term used for vehicles and cars, that where they're taking things apart, stolen vehicles, and replacing the parts and all those kinds of things. When it comes to bicycles, you really have to be careful of labeling something a chop shop, because you have to have evidence to say that the parts are stolen. If you can't prove it, as a police officer, we have to have that evidence. We have to follow the evidence, and we have to prove that the person knowingly has stolen bicycles and bicycle parts that they're putting together. So a lot of people, I mean, there could be a bicycle that has been found. There could be bicycles that have been donated. There could be bicycles that are stolen. But in order to prove that they're stolen, those pieces have to be reported, and that's with a serial number or an engraved driver's license. So, I mean, if we can prove that these parts are stolen and we see somebody, and I think they've called it a chop shop. I haven't used that term before, but just maybe a possession of stolen property would be more of an accurate term from a police officer. We would definitely investigate that. But
right, so it's your impression that chop shops, so to speak, are not, that's not so much an issue. Like, that's kind of a misobservation by the media.
I would say that, or a misconception.
Okay.
I mean, what we were sort of brought to our attention was, hey, we see these everywhere we go. There's a guy that's got a mobile chop shop, and you're not doing anything about it. I said, well, how do you know that those are stolen parts? You might see something, and you might, you know, it's all about perception and what you think and your subjective opinion. But, you know, we have to stop short of being responsible as police officers. We need evidence to say that things are stolen.
Yeah.
And I think the biggest problem here in the city is actually getting reports of stolen bikes with serial numbers and descriptions and engravings on there. So if we do happen to locate a part or a bicycle, it does definitely help us prove that it's stolen, and then we can lay a criminal charge and or return the property to the owner, especially the bike. So that's where 529 comes into play, and some of our other things, where we like to get education pieces out there when it comes to preventing bike theft, such as the location that you choose, such as locking it. We know we recommend two locks, a U-lock and a cable. I mean, there are bike thieves that say, I can easily defeat these, but it's better than not having a lock. And if you put it in an area that's in well sight, I guess, and not hidden behind trees and not dark and not overnight, it's going to discourage bike thieves.
Right, and I wanted to talk a bit more about that, those measures of deterrence. But first, can I just tack back a bit? So you mentioned something interesting that I wanted to talk about, which is kind of figuring out whether someone has stolen something. And so you said that's a matter of evidence. But I had an experience with this after my bike was stolen. I was walking, like, someone told me or recommended to me that I go to the downtown east side and just see if it's there and someone's selling it and I can buy it back. So I was walking through the downtown east side along East Hastings where folks sell goods on the street, and I walked through like Oppenheimer Park, and I saw a lot of bikes, and didn't see my bike, unfortunately, but it made me realize kind of the obvious, but that how can I prove it's my bike if I don't have the serial number? And also, it made me feel very uncomfortable thinking of accusing someone who's living in poverty of stealing. And so, yeah, could you talk about how the VPD deals with this issue of potentially profiling people who are living in poverty?
Well, I think from us, we follow the rule of evidence, and that's in any type of investigation. No matter what, as a police department, we have to follow evidence and the rule of law. And basically, that's we need reasonable grounds to suspect that there's crimes, and we need to investigate. That's when it comes to arresting somebody and whether or not we have the evidence there. So when it comes to thefts, and you hit the nail on the head, you may see your bike, but if you haven't, if you don't have proof with a receipt with your serial number, and that's where we go back to where we recover a lot of bikes through the course, and roughly over 2,000 a year we have we have to sell them. People will show up and say, that's my bike right there. And we just say, well, how do you prove that?
Yeah.
For example, kind of like a lost wallet with no ID in it. You say, well, it's brown leather and it has $2 in it. Well, somebody else could say the same thing. So you need to be able to prove that. And that's where we're really sort of pushing it to make sure you take pictures of your bike, have your receipts, take serial numbers, engrave it, use Project 529.
Right.
And definitely log it so that you can come to us and say, that is my bike. Or I mean, the other side of it is if you do see somebody, you've recently had your bike stolen, and you see a bike, and especially if it's very distinctive, and you see somebody on it, that's a crime in progress, and you need to call 911 under those circumstances.
Right.
If you can say, that's my bike, it was just stolen, it's got a red seat, I know it's my bike, even though maybe you haven't seen the serial number, we can definitely investigate that further, and we would recommend that you call 911 for a crime in progress.
So, for example, if you see someone pulling like a cart with a bunch of bikes, or you see in a tent or under a sheet or something a bunch of bikes that someone has, do the police go and look at those bikes to see if the any serial numbers match reported missing bikes, or is it like is that kind of just harassment of people? Like, what is cause to investigate?
Yeah, it's hard to get into, and I think it has to not just to deal with bikes, but anytime we get a report of a crime, we have to follow the evidence, whether it's a stolen bike or not. And people have, you know, there's a charter of rights that we have to follow, and people have rights. But we also have to try and investigate these reports. And if it has to go beyond mere suspicion. So if you look at somebody and say, I think that those bikes are stolen, well, how do you know? And that's when we start, you know, we're going to ask some pretty pointed and hard questions and saying, well, how do you know? Well, I just suspect it. Well, that's sometimes not good enough. So we have to make sure that we have the evidence that we need. If and there's all kinds of different scenarios, but if you have a scenario where you're watching somebody cutting a lock and you watch them get on that bike and drive away and you flag over a police officer, we're going to go after that. That to us, that's an in-progress crime. It still could be an issue of maybe it's his bike, but he lost his key and he had to go borrow some bolt cutters and cut the bolts. So you see, there's all kinds. We have to be careful when it comes to investigations and just really follow the evidence. And you know, but we need people in when it comes to bike thefts to definitely log it, log the serial numbers. That helps us to do our job because time and time again, we highly suspect that bikes are stolen. We find them in possession of somebody, but they're not reported. And we have the serial number. We run it, and it comes back as nothing because the person didn't have it prior to it being stolen, and it was never on our system. So if we don't have that, the person goes, we take the bike, and then we end up auctioning it off later on and not returning it. So it's a very frustrating process, and that's sort of the biggest takeaway from this is we just really want to push people to record their serial numbers, identify their parts, and definitely log it so that if something, if it is taken, you can call us with that information.
Right. So when I was doing some research on bike theft in Vancouver, I saw there was an article published by News 1130 from October 2018 where Vancouver police officers were, someone filmed Vancouver police officers wearing plainclothes standing by as someone stole a bike he was cutting the lock, but they asked him, like, is this your bike? Can you show us ID? And he did, and he said he just lost his key. But then, right. as it turned out, he was lying, and he okay. was just stealing the bike. So right. what kind of measures does someone have to – or what kind of measures do the police take to get someone to prove it's their bike? Like, if showing ID isn't enough, do you make them, you know – show a photo of it?
Yeah, I mean, it's up to each individual officer's discretion how mm-hmm. they investigate something. But something like that is, you're definitely going to detain the person. You have enough evidence to detain them. And what that means is, when it comes to the law, whether it's a crime, you're investigating a theft. Mm-hmm. You could be investigating an assault, but you need, it's called investigative detention is what you're talking about. Then it moves on to an arrest where you're arresting somebody where you think it's, okay, they weren't able to prove it. I mean, you might have to do some follow-up later on. You might seize the bike, identify the person, and release them pending further investigative steps that you need to do later on to try and look in to see it. And it might turn out that it's certainly not his bike. We could always forward charges to Crown Council for theft at a later date, but we've recovered the bike, those kinds of things. So it's really up to the officers and how the officers that are actually investigating that, how they articulate why they did what they did. So
right.
it starts off with you're going to be detaining somebody, and it's going to move on from an investigative detention onto an arrest and then hopefully to charges. So that's
right.
how that sort of process works. But that's the same in any criminal investigation.
Right. And they did eventually get the bike back because they had taken his ID so they could find him, and they returned the bike.
Sure.
But something that the person who took the video of that bike being stolen pointed out is that it's really hard to tell often if a bike is being stolen unless you get up close, because often when people are cutting the lock or undoing it in some way, it looks like they're unlocking their bike. So
right.
Anyway, it's often hard for people to even cite that a bike is being stolen and report it.
Yeah, exactly. And the criminals are very good at hiding that fact that they're stealing.
Right. And then you've mentioned, of course, the importance of reporting your bike and reporting the serial number and any markings and identifying features. But could you tell people a little bit more about the app 529 Garage?
Yeah, so what it is you can actually go on there too. It's got a whole bunch of features on there. You basically register your bike on the 529 app.
Yeah.
And if it's stolen or another bike is stolen, you'll get alerts through the app of stolen bikes. So it's alerting other cyclists out there to be on the lookout for this bike.
Mm.
It also puts you through a process where you have to take pictures of your bike, record your serial numbers, a lot of very distinguishing features about your bike that if it's gone, you can go to the app and recover that to give to the police.
Right.
So it really helps us. So it's another tool. You can also look on there if you're thinking of buying a bike and you suspect maybe it is stolen or something,
mm-hmm.
you can look on a bit of a hot sheet and it'll list recently stolen bikes on there.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a few functions you can use it, but it's... you're registering it, you can report it if it's stolen, and it helps in the recovery process of getting these bikes back to the owner. So it's the three R's.
Okay, yeah. I'm wondering, like, we talked about chop shops a bit, but so, like, my assumption was that basically if a bike is stolen, at least in East Van, it's usually going to be chopped up and sold for parts or put together, kind of Frankenstein together as a new bike, because that way it's less identifiable. But would you say in most cases bikes remain intact and, like, you can maybe see someone and identify they've stolen it? Is that more likely?
That's a tough one. I mean, that's
yeah.
Once it's stolen, all of those scenarios are possible. So.
Mm-hmm. Lastly, I just wanted to ask if you have any stories that stand out to you of bike theft that have happened. I've been chatting with my coworkers a bit, and a lot of people have pretty crazy stories of, like, how their bikes got stolen or parts of their bikes. I was wondering, do you have any you'd want to share?
You know what? I don't have any as a police officer that I can recall. I do know I've been involved in a lot of sort of in-progress bike calls, and they are...
okay.
They can be difficult for us because once they go mobile on a bike, and we're in a car,
mm-hmm.
they can go on a bike path that a car can't go, and they can easily get away from us.
Right.
So it makes it difficult. I do know that stolen bikes can also be used in a lot of other crimes, such as B&Es and purse snatchings or shopliftings or all kinds of things where they'll just set the bike up facing downhill and it's just sitting there and they'll go in and maybe shoplift. And if anybody's chasing them, they have the stolen goods and they just jump on the bike and it's an easy getaway. And if you're on foot, it's really hard to catch them. And even for a police officer, especially if they're on a bike, they can get away quite quickly even from our dogs, even if we're pursuing them on foot and if we're in a car. It makes it hard, but I do know of a couple cases where even with that, we've managed to catch them. Oftentimes, we'll be investigating another crime. Mm-hmm. We just happen to see somebody on a bike that maybe they're too big or too small for, or it doesn't match them, or it's a very expensive bike. Mm-hmm. We just simply ask them, and we're doing another, investigating something else. Where is that your bike? Because we want to return it, or we just find it, and they just say, I just found it. Okay. Mm-hmm. Then we go from there. Okay, then we look at the serial number, and that, those are the times where the guy's going to say, well, it's not mine. I just found it, or my friend loaned it to me. Mm-hmm. So now we're stuck with this bike. We run the serial number, and it doesn't come back stolen. So we're not giving it back to them, but yeah, we have it in our possession, but we don't know who or how to get it back to it. And so we keep going back maybe through 529 or other ways now. We love it if we're able to give you that call and say, hey, we have your bike.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're able to maybe get charges and pursue criminal charges on this. So there's been a lot of stumbling blocks, but I don't know if that answered your question or not. But
yeah, no, that's helpful. But then, so if you see someone riding a bike and it looks too big or too small for them, is that that's kind of cause to ask them if it's their bike?
Not necessarily. I think that's a little weak still, but it might be as a good police officer. There's all kinds of little things that you see over the course of your experience as a patrol officer. Mm-hmm. You might see something that just doesn't seem right, and that could be one of those things. But you have to articulate, and you need a bit more than that. Mm-hmm. So maybe, like I said before, we even just that alone is likely not enough.
Mm-hmm.
But it might be enough to say we see that person riding without a helmet. Now, we want to go up to and issue them a ticket for riding without a helmet, and that gives us illegal grounds to do so, but we're also aware that, hey, this bike doesn't really fit that person.
Right.
And then we go to approach them to write them a ticket, and they take off from us, which now our suspicion is going, this bike could be stolen because they're fleeing from us. We had the grounds to check them for the helmet. And these, we could go over a bunch of different scenarios, but each officer has to articulate why and the evidence that they have.
Right.
Stop somebody. And normally, if you're writing a ticket to somebody, if you're riding a bicycle on a sidewalk, that's against the Motor Vehicle Act. And you could go and write them a ticket and stop them and ask them for ID. And while you're doing that, you might start investigating a stolen bike because the bike might not look like it's there. I mean, the same kind of evidence, rule of evidence goes along the same lines as, say, there's been a bunch of break-ins to cars late at night in a certain area, and you see somebody wearing all black at 3 a.m. and they're acting suspiciously and hiding around a bush where we've just had a whole bunch of break-ins. You may want to go check that person or talk to them as a police officer. Do you have enough to arrest them? No, they could be lost. They could be. So there's a lot of what if scenarios, and that's where our officers have to articulate their grounds.
Right. They have to articulate their grounds. And
right.
Other than that, it's up to their discretion.
Well, their discretion, their experience, how they articulate why they did what they did in any case. And that's throughout our all of our duties here, whether we're investigating a stolen bike or any other criminal offense, or we want to write somebody a ticket for something. It starts small and we build pretty quickly.
Great. Well, thank you very much for your time. That's all the questions I have.
Okay.
So thanks very much. And
you're welcome.
Have a nice day.
Okay, you too.
Okay, take care.
Take care. Bye-bye. Every now and then I fall apart.
All right. Thank you for listening. This is Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. We've been focusing on bike theft. But after this break, we're going to chat with a local pizzeria owner about how making Italian food connects with food science. So we're just going to hear a couple ads and we'll be right back. Please stay tuned.
Good people of CITR land of Vancouver, of the lower mainland, not really. My name is Chris Sarific. August 23rd at the Toast Collective. That's Friday. Or, as I like to call it, the day that I find out how unbelievably unpopular my show is.
We've only just begun.
Come celebrate 20 years of the Parts Unknown show with Chris Sarific and special guests Garbage Dreams, Jerk Jails, and from Missoula, Montana, Wrinkles. It is also the release of Chris Sarific's new album, Treats. That's Friday, August 23rd at the Toast Collective.
We are High School for Recording Arts Los Angeles.
You may have heard about our school in Minnesota, but we started something new and great right here in LA.
HSRA is the new family in town. Our students have created the song Smashing Out to let others feel our energy and to represent the culture HSRA is building.
We all came from different backgrounds, and we're seeking a different form of learning. We found it here at HSRA.
Together, we started a student record label. Smashing Out is the first song we produce.
We also just dropped a music video for this song. It represents our energy, our personalities, and our culture.
You can find us on IG at HSRA_LA, and you can contact me, our student manager, Empress, E-M-P-R-E-S-S, .Hill01 at NewBillCharter.org, or reach the school at 320-428-0854.
320-428-0854. Dream me till I see that
HSRA. All right, and we're back. This is Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. So as I mentioned before the break, we've been focusing on bike theft on today's show, but we're now turning our attention to local business. So in studio with me is Adeline Pang, one of the News Collective comrades, and she sat down with a local pizzeria chef and owner, business owner, to chat about his business and the sort of magic of Italian food. So did you want to tell us anything about what drew you to this interview, Adeline, before we play your piece?
Actually, over the last 6 weeks, I was taking a food science course. And cool. So when we had the option to either do a Wikipedia project or an interview option, I decided that the interview option seemed pretty cool because I'd done a few interviews previously.
Cool. In your class, did you learn about Italian food or making pizza specifically?
Not specific food, like not specific ways of making food, but just in general. So like different areas of the world, that's something that we can like kind of, we'll have to like research on our own, but the general processes.
Sweet. Cool. Well, let's take a listen to your interview. So this is with Jimmy Kinda, and he is the owner and executive chef of Bella Roma Pizzeria, which is on West 10th in Vancouver. They make great pizza. So here we go. Let's take a listen.
Thank you for joining us today on CITR 101.9 FM. I'm Adeline Payne. During the BC Day long weekend, I sat down with the owner of a local restaurant to discuss how the process of making Italian food connects various food science principles, such as the role of flavor, quality of ingredients, texture of pizza dough, sweeteners, and customer satisfaction. Let's take a listen. So we're here with Jimmy Kinda, the owner and executive chef of Bella Roma Pizza and Ristorante on West 10th in Point Grey in Vancouver. Before opening Bella Roma, Jimmy spent around 3 years in Italy while he familiarized himself with the local ingredients, spices, preparation, and serving techniques. He was also a chef at Executive Inn Hotels in BC and has worked globally in various restaurants and hotels in Italy, France, Germany, and the US. Thank you so much for chatting with us today.
Thank you, ma'am, for taking me today. Thank you.
No worries.
So we'll start with a very general question about what kinds of tastes are most prominent in Italian dishes.
So Duval is whoever came to my restaurants, he feel it like a real taste as like Italy. So we try our best, so they are happy to be get a good food like Italian. Flavors, yeah.
So would you describe the taste as more of a like salty or umami kind of taste or spicy?
Well, no, we do it like everybody can eat. Like it's not over spices, like perfect flavors, balance.
And so what kinds of sensations would you describe like Italian food as? Would you say it's more of a sharp taste or?
Italian's food.
Yeah.
Is like full flavors. Oh, okay. If you like really like to enjoy it, you need a full flavors. It's okay. Not like to be less salt. You need be, if you want to come to our restaurants, especially Bella Roma's, we having perfect balanced flavor for each person. Yeah.
Oh, I see. Yeah, well, that's great. So I understand that you make your own balsamic dressing.
Yes, I do.
Yeah, for your salad. Why did you decide to make these kinds of condiments in-house?
Yeah, I try my best to be keep it my own dressings. Never know in future if everyone love it, I'm going to make my own brand, try to sell it, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what are the main differences that you anticipate between like in-house made items and store-bought items?
You know what, like a homemade make a total difference, you know? It's the fresh and more our my own ingredients. If you buy from market or somewhere else, who knows, they are made exactly, nobody knows, but we make a fresh. To every day. We buy it and we sell it every day.
Yeah. So are there any preservatives that you incorporate in these types of items to make the condiments last longer, like if you store it?
No. So right now we don't do anything. No storage, anything.
Oh, okay.
We try to make it every day fresh. Maximum 1 or 2 days. We try to sell it every day. Yeah. We don't keep a lot of things in freezer.
Well, that's great. Yeah.
Next, I was curious about how Jimmy would describe the texture of pizza dough, particularly Bella Roma's signature brick oven pizza.
It's real, each person's, who is the pizzaiola?
Right.
He has his own recipe, which way we make it, this is our very standards, very common from Italy. So, main part, once you make the pizza, comes from the oven, make sure be nice and crispy,
right.
Not be soggy. So it's my believe it, once we make the dough, we do like very simple,
right.
Like as everybody does. So make sure once came, it should be crust. Like it should be like our crust is like cookie, we say cookie way, you know.
Right, yeah.
As soon as you put in the mouth, crack in your mouth, that's mean good crust,
right.
Not be soggy. Should be if you hold each slice on the hand, it will be stand as a slice.
And also, what are the grades of ingredients that are usually used in a dish? For example, for beef, there's like prime beef, AA beef, or like...
Yeah. About the beef, we're using for AAA.
Oh, AAA.
And everyone love it. We get like really... everyone love it. You know, AAA is the best, you know.
Right.
It's qualified beef, yeah.
Oh, I see.
Since I tried a tiramisu during my previous visit to Bella Roma, I decided to inquire about what makes a Bella Roma dessert unique.
So, are there any kinds of particular sweeteners that are used to prepare Italian dishes?
You know, I can do a lot of things like desserts, cream caramel, tiramisu, or panna cotta. So, whoever came to my place, everyone tried, they love it. And everyone appreciate. They said we love it, and they say they love it.
Oh, know? I see. So is cream like a huge part of the different types of?
Oh yeah, that is most important. As we make it like a tiramisu, we always try control the like not to be like is like a fat. We try to control less.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, that is our exactly. If we make Alfredo sauce, whatever we make it, we make some like less fat in there.
Oh, I see. Are there any other substitutes that you use for sugar, for example?
Yes, we do. It's like a sugar. Basically, we use for desserts. You know, sugar give a happiness anyway.
Right, right, yeah.
We love it, but as we are take it, I can say sugar is, everyone love it, but we try to be controlled to be served.
Oh, so it's the portion, like you try to control the portion.
Portions, yeah.
The percent of sugars.
This segment was reported and produced by Adeline Peng, with music courtesy of Lounge Music. Many thanks to Bella Roma, Pizzeria, and Ristorante, and the News Collective at CITR 101.9 FM.
All right. This is Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. Adeline, thank you for that lovely trip to the hills of Italy.
My pleasure.
Cool. So we're almost at 6 p.m., so we're going to sign out. Thanks very much to everyone who is listening, if anyone's listening. We appreciate your attention. We'll be back again next Thursday at 5 p.m. with more local news. Check out our podcast, Seeking Office, on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. We should probably put it on Spotify, too. I hear the young people listen to podcasts on Spotify. Yeah? Okay. Okay. Thanks very much, and have a lovely weekend, everyone.